You're listening to
Potluck. And what is poppin', everybody? You're listening to the Good Pop Culture Club, episode 190. My name is Marvin Yue, and joining me to talk about all the good pop that gets us through our days is the once and future professional Asian American Jess Ju. What's up, Jess?
That was my best attempt at like a Godzilla scream.
I feel like you just blew out the mic. Like the noise canceling and the Zoom kicked in, and
maybe
I don't know what kind of sounds gonna. Maybe I will just slice in the actual Godzilla scream.
Although, oh my god,
that's probably copyrighted. Okay. I don't want to get sued, or I don't want to get David Changed. You know,
pitch it up. Okay, I'm just gonna go. You know. Insert here.
Yeah, it's just okay. You and me today, Jess. Han Win, our usual co-host, is off on, not even on vacation. She's off on assignment covering, I guess they're doing like a press junket for the new Alien show in Thailand, which seems like a fun way to, how do we get on those junkets?
It's apparently not about Ripley, it's not the alien Ripley. It's the con man Matt Damon Ripley. Is it?
What?
She's doing Alien.
Yeah.
Oh my god, did I just make a cognitive leap? I just made a cognitive leap.
No, because there was a show called Ripley, which I thought was about the Alien.
I thought that was the Alien show.
We live in a weird time. We live in a time where Godzilla Minus One exists, and for some reason we decided to do this episode on Kong X Godzilla, the New Empire, instead. And I don't know how this keeps happening. I don't know how I keep letting you talk me into watching things like Irish Wish and this film, but here we are.
This is unhinged. This is like when the responsible adult Han is away. I'm going to binge on junk food and like, you know, be a menace. And the one of those things is making you watch Kong versus Godzilla, I feel, or Kong X Godzilla. I don't even know how you would.
It's Godzilla X Kong, the New Empire.
Godzilla
comes first. He's first in the billing.
Okay, which, you know, I would disagree with the narrative plot. Like, within the story, it's definitely a King Kong movie. But I do think it's like, oh, how would you verbally say that? Like, you know, because we understand the X means it's a pairing. But you don't really say X, do you? But yes, anyways.
I feel like if it's an X, it should just be a ship name, right? It should be
Godzilla, this is the ship,
or something, right? Kongzilla? Yeah.
I think that's like one layer too deep in like internet world for like a general public. But I do feel like, you know, my pitch to you was like, we are like, this is like the Kong Godzilla team up of this podcast, because we will team up to battle other weird alien podcast monkey titans. I would also like to disclaimer at the top of the show that I have not watched any of the other movies in this movie franchise. I have literally just jumped in on what I believe is the fifth installation in this franchise.
Wait, so here's where we are not the same, because in preparation of watching Godzilla X Kong, the New Empire, I did go back and watch Godzilla, King of the Monsters, and Godzilla versus Kong.
That's on you. I did not request that. I was like, I feel like, you know, these movies do not require additional work, which is why I went in. And you know what? I got it. You get the broad strokes. I don't think you're missing anything.
Yeah, we'll get into that a little bit later. Definitely a lot to discuss about this this film. But before we get to that, as always, let's start off by finding out what other pop culture is speaking us through this week. Jess, besides Godzilla X Kong, what's poppin'?
Oh, yes, because I am the most relevant tastemaker, representative of my entire millennial generation. I spent the weekend, or one of my days this weekend, attending the Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band concert at the Forum. That was sarcasm, if anyone is unclear. Me and my husband were definitely the youngest people who bought their own tickets at this venue. But I will say, I do claim it as tangentially Asian American, because I got into Bruce Springsteen because of the movie Blinded by the Light, which you and I, Marvin, saw together at Sundance.
Yeah.
Several years ago. A different world, a different life.
I will admit his songs are awfully catchy, and I can see how, you know, that film probably introduced a whole new generation of Asian / Stacey kids to Bruce Springsteen.
I mean, I love the movie. I don't know if it had kind of like the cultural legs, say like Bend It Like Beckham, the filmmaker's first film did. But yeah, it definitely hooked me. But I will say one of the kind of like discrepancies is that film is set specifically like in the 80s, right? So we're talking most of that film, the music is set from like his earlier discography. And you know, Bruce Springsteen, 74 years old, looks amazing, very energetic. This man and his band, the E Street Band, played a 3-hour plus set, no breaks. Pretty incredible. Sounds great. I can't even do that now, right? Like, so I will say, like, respect where respect is due. They don't make shit like this anymore. At least the men. I feel like men, this is my hot take, I think male like musicians, pop stars these days, they don't try hard enough. They don't give it on stage. I think, you know, in the patriarchy, it's not expected of them. But you can kind of tell from like, especially from like these older kind of musicians, the ones who like really love what they do and they still are like rocking it at like in their like 70s and 80s. Very similar with Paul McCartney. I'm just like, this man did not stop for 3 hours. And you're like, oh, this is like a lifetime of like skill, knowledge, and experience just like coming out. And his band is incredible, which is like, you know, he is very consistently has always like build his band, the E Street Band, as part of his act. And it is very cool to see, like, you know, there were like long instrumental breaks. There were like, he has a horn section that travels with him. He has like oh, and fun fact, his guitarist is Silvio Dante from The Sopranos.
Well, I have a question.
Did you know this?
Is his drummer still Max Weinberg from The Late Show?
It is. Max Weinberg was the drummer, which is like, you know, that's crazy. So I had a really great time. It was really great to see, even though the one problem with people who have such like a longevity is that they like to play whatever they want to play. You know, he's not touring a specific album, which is like fair. You've earned the right to do whatever the fuck you want. But at the same time, you're just like, Brucey, let's be real. You know what the people want. We do not need as much letters to you, which is like from like his like within the last 10 years. Like, do people want letters to you? No, we want like Born in the USA. We want Born to Run. And he knew which ones were the like audience hits, because when the audience goes crazy, he just like doesn't even sing, right? Like, and many artists do that when it's like their big hits. They're just like, hey, audience, sing along. And you're like, Bruce, come on now, please.
I mean, the
more 80s stuff, more late 70s, 80s Bruce Springsteen, please.
I mean, yeah, I mean, you definitely went for a specific part of his catalog. And I think that's the thing with like, it's like bands that we followed in high school, but we haven't followed since. And they've had maybe 2 or 3 albums since then. It's like, you gotta sit through all the new stuff to get to the stuff.
And like, we get it. You don't want to be boxed in. Like, I get it. You don't like Michelle Branch. I know you don't want to sing everywhere for the rest of your life, but like, come on. We're here for everywhere. Give the paying people what they want. Yeah, but overall had a great time. We'll say, and again, this is even coming from me, you know, this was the widest space I have ever been in. The widest and the malest space I've ever been in overall. And really? That includes like the Paul McCartney concert. That includes like Elton John concert. That includes like Fleetwood Mac. That includes like my theater world. I'm just like, oh, this is a demographic I would not encounter in any other, you know, really in any other space. Maybe like a Dolly Parton concert, but you know, Dolly Parton, everyone loves Dolly. And it was really funny because Bruce Springsteen also, let's be real, I think at the core, he's like pretty decent guy. Like, I don't think I'd have to fight Bruce Springsteen. You know, he did give Gurinder Chadha the right to his music to make this movie about like this immigrant Pakistani British family.
I mean, he seems like a cool dude. He seems. I mean,
he sent cease and desist letters to Republican. you know, like law, like politicians all the time who try to use his music
it's
for
just
his,
so
their
funny
rallies.
Because his songs are just such Americana, but like the real America, the ones that are like Born on the 4th of July, hands down, probably the most misunderstood song in like the entire like American musical catalog, right?
I mean, he had an anti-cop song and had the cop unions protesting him in 2000. You know what I mean? Like he is pretty consistent. He's been pretty consistent his entire career in what he writes about and like I think generally the values he stands for. So like, you know, as I'm walking out after like a great concert and I'm just like, why are you wearing a thin blue line shirt, lady? Like did you just miss the entire message? Like and speaking of like rage, he brought out Tom Morello.
Oh wow.
And they did two songs together and then we didn't realize it was Tom Morello because you know they were kind of focusing on the guitar playing first and then it pans and we're like, oh my god, that's Tom Morello of Rage Against the Machine. And that was amazing. And Tom Morello was also the blackest person in that room. So I'm just like, ooh, this is a different crowd than I usually am in share space with. But overall, had a great time. Really grateful to have caught him, you know, with these folks, with these older musicians, I'm like, could be the last time. You could die.
To be fair, Jess, you do go to a lot of musical theater, which is a pretty white space too, isn't it?
It's white, but it's a little more feminine. Like, it's a little more, like, queer and, like, women-coded. Like, this is, like, pretty, like, there were some just dudes bro-ing out. Like, dudes having a good time. Not a rhythmic move in the bunch. The dancing was a little hard to watch, but you know what? Everyone's having fun, so had a good time. And I this is like just my thing. Like I just like going to these like old boomery concerts. Like I think we're gonna go try to hit the Def Leppard Journey tour that's coming around this summer. If you have any interest, you should know where to find me.
I'm good.
All right. But what's popping with you, Marvin?
All right. What's popping with me is after watching Godzilla X Kong for this week's episode, I felt like I needed to go watch some classic Godzilla as like, I guess, a companion viewing. So I went and watched Shin Godzilla, which is streaming on Crunchyroll. Shin Godzilla is the 2016 reboot. Co-directed by Hideaki Anno, who's best known for his work creating the Evangelion series. So man knows his way around giant kaiju battles. So Shin Godzilla takes place in modern Japan and follows the classic story of Godzilla making landfall in Japan and causing havoc and chaos. The main difference in this version is, you know, we talked about how the original Godzilla was an allegory, a metaphor for nuclear arms proliferation, Hiroshima, the atomic bomb. Shin Godzilla, on the other hand, is more of a metaphor for the Fukushima disaster in 2011 and the government's handling
Ooh,
of it.
Ooh, rough.
Yeah, so the first half of the film actually plays almost like an Iannucci movie.
Oh,
where
no, or they're just like bumbling idiots.
Yeah, I mean, just a lot of bureaucrats who are hesitant to make any decisive action because of how it may look politically. And so let this situation, this crisis with like this giant radioactive lizard just get worse and worse.
The true villain.
Yeah, I mean, the true kaiju, I guess, was bureaucracy and politicians all along.
That sounds fun. I'm happy. For you, this just sounds very stressful.
Yeah, but I mean, it's also portrayed in a really funny way. This is definitely a satire, right? Like one of the early scenes is this meeting of government officials talking about a disturbance off the coast of Japan. And once they learn that the situation is much more complicated than they originally thought, decide to adjourn the meeting to call an even higher level meeting, smash cut to a bigger meeting room with more people talking about the same thing.
Oh, that's really funny, actually.
Yeah, I think you would really enjoy this film, Jess. As someone who has put up with a lot of bureaucratic nonsense, the amount of times people in power get like "I told you so" moments from their subordinates is just perfect.
I might check this one out because you know my husband, who knows me very well and is also actually a very tried and true Godzilla fan, has told me multiple times that the most recent Godzilla movie, Godzilla Minus One, would be something I do not like because he as his words said, there's a lot of male angst that I feel you would not enjoy. So I will take his word on that. But this sounds fun. Fun? As fun as a monster destroyer. I mean, that's pretty fun. So yeah, maybe I'll check it out. Where is it playing?
Right now, it's streaming on Crunchyroll, which is the anime streaming service. And I'm looking forward to hearing your thoughts, especially about the baby Godzilla.
There's a baby?
I mean, it's a really fucked up looking baby Godzilla.
No!
It looks really like it's like wiggly and maybe a little furry looking.
Sounds kind of cute. Potential to be cute.
I mean, Shin Godzilla has probably one of the most like messed up looking Godzillas in the Godzilla canon. It's like, you know, it's by the guy who made Evangelion. So it's like he loves making like fucked up kaijus. And so, you know, starts off as like a wiggly baby and it quickly evolves into like a monstrous, like almost like Joker-fied Godzilla. It's definitely super unsettling. But yeah, totally dug this film and definitely recommend it. It was nice to watch a Godzilla film with something to say after watching two Godzilla films.
Oh, that have absolutely nothing to say is the equivalent of cramming down movie theater nacho cheese in your gullet.
Exactly. Oh, well, on that note, that's what's popping for this week. Just a lot of Godzilla content and more to come. But before we get to that, it's time once again to check in with Top Chef with our podcast within a podcast, Go Asian, where each week we follow our Asians competing in this season of Top Chef until they all get eliminated or one of them wins. This week, we are recapping episode 3 of Top Chef Wisconsin, which technically came out last week. By the time you hear this podcast, episode 4 will already have aired. But, you know, just the way that our recording timing works, this is what we have to do.
It's how the cookie crumbles. Yeah.
Exactly. But on episode 3 of Top Chef, our Asians were kind of all over the place. Most did well, but we did lose our first Asian of the season. Kenny Nguyen, unfortunately, did not make it past the cheese.
Yeah, he just wasn't being able to like conceptualize dishes in the way that you need to for Top Chef.
Which is a bummer because he has like spurts of brilliance, but just
and his food does. I mean, I love Viet food like so much. So like his food generally like kind of sounds good, but then I'm like, come on, dude, you didn't make enough slaw, and then you have to like ration the slaw. Like that's amateur hour. I'm sorry.
I mean, his concept was to create a crab rangoon salad with blue cheese for an outdoor festival catering challenge. And I kind of feel like even if he did pull it off, it probably wouldn't have like performed well anyway.
It's fine. Like a fancy crab rangoon sounds delicious, but you know, it's the execution. And they always say, you know, it's also like this was like the first like mass feed people in like a mass festival challenge, right? Of the season, and that's always like Schneider Freud always happens in these, right? Like the weather's always crazy, and like the wind always gets you, and someone can't like make things fast enough, or so there's always an element to that. But
yeah, I mean, he did struggle all episode, right? Like he was also on the bottom for the quickfire this episode, which was a door cherry cooking challenge, which I didn't realize. I don't really pay attention to where my cherries come from. I just assume most of my produce comes from California because it's where I live.
Because we're West Coast elitists. Yeah. Yeah, me too. I thought cherries came from like California or like Washington maybe.
Yeah. I mean, this was the first quickfire that, the only other one was the hops one. This was the first one I feel like didn't sound like a total nightmare for the chefs. And Kenny still struggled even though he had marshmallows, which, you know, might not be the common pairing, but didn't seem like a stretch to pair sweet with tart, right?
It probably wasn't the weirdest pairing, right? Like marshmallow and cherry. Like,
yeah, I mean, some of the other chefs definitely got harder pairings. One of the chefs got ginger, one of the chefs got like chicken liver. Rossica got chipolini onions and knocked it out of the park with her onions and tart cherries with charred pepper relish and Berber spice.
That does sound good, though. But yeah, girl, Rossica, you know, wants some money in the quickfire. I think as long as she stays cool and composed, she has a fair shot of going pretty far because she's kooky, right?
She could do. I mean, she's doing well. I wouldn't call her cool and composed, but
she's not.
If she can keep her chaos reined in, like, and you know, our guest judge was Carla Hall, who also similarly has chaos energy, but was able to rein it in at the end of her season. And I definitely see Rossica doing well if she can follow like the Carla Hall like trajectory, right?
Yes.
And her other Asian chef, the adoptee, Kalima, did pretty well this episode too. She ended up on the top with her mac and cheese. Although it didn't seem like it was a very deep field, because most of the chefs did croquettes, and only like one of them did it well.
Everyone did a croquette, and then I think there were just like the bad dishes were just way worse.
Yeah,
like within these dishes, right? Like poor Manny just did not know what to do with these cheese curd things. And you know, surprisingly, Kevin fucked up the brie. I mean, can you show your face back in France after that? I don't know. But I mean,
maybe that's why he's Kevin from France.
And Kevin from France, but we'll see. He snuck through. So we'll see how we're down one. We still got a few.
Yeah,
we might have one more coming back.
Yeah, and then in Last Chance Kitchen, we had an Asian off. Bonus Asian Su-on against Kenny in a Limburger challenge, which apparently is the stinkiest of cheeses.
Yes, I've actually never had Limburger cheese. I want to go try it now because I do love stinky cheese. but yeah, you know, Kenny, again, couldn't conceptualize in time quickly enough. So.
But here's the thing, like his dish actually came together this time. And Tom actually said it was a tough choice. And, you know, his idea of a Limburger pizza on a Vietnamese rice wrap sounded really cool. And, you know, it's the type of thing he was trying to pull off in the regular competition, right? This isn't the first time he used Vietnamese flavors or a rice wrap. Like, he used Vietnamese rice paper in the quickfire, but it didn't work out that time. And it was a little sad to see him, like, turn the corner at this point in the competition one step too late, right? Because I think we talked about this offline before, but Last Chance Kitchen is judged only by Tom. And so I feel like, in general, Sue's eggplant parmesan had an edge, being like something that's more in Tom's wheelhouse, right?
Yeah, I'm also just like, I don't think this is the like if we're going to talk, if any part of this competition has a little more like producer hands-on, it's going to be Last Chance Kitchen, right? Like, I just always remember when Shirley, well, you know, one of our favorites in her past season, when, you know, when she saw Brooke walk out from Last Chance Kitchen, Shirley's, oh, there's no way I'm going to win this season. She's like, I just know, like, they're not going to like bring this woman who herself got knocked out from a Last Chance Kitchen, aka Kirsten, and then like bring her back and then like not have her win. So she, you know, there is a little more like, I think, story manipulation when it comes to Last Chance Kitchen. Like, they're not going to bring in this like random extra X factor chef and then not have him go to like round four or five, right? Like, I think he's just gonna at least make it to that like last challenge before you get back into
he's gonna
game.
Show up on the show at least once.
Unless he majorly does not fuck up, and I'm sure they cast someone like who probably was very good at like this kind of challenge or like quick fires. There's no point. Like, why introduce this like element?
It is weird. We still don't know exactly what happened with Cowboy Hat Dave, who
but you know
been...
what? That's fine. That's fine. I will take Sue over Cowboy Hat Dave any day.
Yeah. All right. So one Asian out, three still in the competition, technically two in the competition proper, one going through top Last Chance Kitchen. How do we feel about our Asians right now? Like, Raska, I'm very high on. Kalima, I still don't know what to make of her.
She's not my favorite contestant. I think her... I think she made her own comment. She's like, oh, I didn't make my own noodles. I'm like, yeah, girl, you just made mac and cheese. Like, is that... That might have gotten you, you know, high on this list, but is that like... Is that the ambition of a winner? Is that the ambition of a Top Chef winner? I don't think so. Yeah. But, you know, we'll see.
I feel overall the contestants this year aren't really like, besides Rossica, who's like putting her whole like self into everything she makes every challenge, not really seeing a lot of like people playing to win so far, right?
It's a little early, but so I think right now might still be like survival slash like getting the hang of things. But, you know, the winner of this challenge was Michelle, who's not Asian, but did make an Asian inspired dish. And I do really like Michelle and just kind of her background of being a pit master, but having, you know, obviously has like a wide range of experience to like pull off Indian food, to pull off pasta, fresh pasta to pull off, you know, all these different things. Even so, and so, yeah, so I find her very interesting as well. Yeah. So,
and also on the top actually was maybe another, would we consider him a bonus Asian? Dan from Wisconsin?
No, absolutely not. Moving on.
All right. Well, Go Asian lives on. Still three in the running. And yeah, excited to see how far we go. Excited to see if Sue makes it back in the competition. And man, Top's just tonight, actually, the night that we record this. So I'm going to go watch this after we finish chatting.
I have wait until tomorrow, so no spoilers.
All right. Well, that's what's popping for this week. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're talking about Godzilla versus not Godzilla, Godzilla X Kong, the new empire. Stick around. So excited.
Hey, I'm Kim Cooper, and I co-host the podcast Asians in Baseball alongside Naomi Koh and Scott Okamoto. Asians in Baseball is exactly what it sounds like. A podcast about the Asian and Asian Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander Americans in Major League Baseball. Every week, we break down the highlights of what's going on with Asians in baseball and then take a deeper dive into the Asian and Asian Americans past and present who have shaped baseball as it is today. Whether you're Kim Eng's number one fan or you've never even heard of Hideo Nomo, we've got something for everyone, especially for the Shohei Ohtani stands. Maybe too much for the Shohei Ohtani stands. Listen to Asians in Baseball wherever you get podcasts. Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.
Hi, I'm Marvin.
And I'm Rira.
And we're the hosts of Books and Boba, a book club and podcast dedicated to books by Asian and Asian American authors.
Each month, we pick a book by an Asian author to read and discuss on the show.
We read a variety of genres, including contemporary and historical fiction, sci-fi and fantasy, romance and cozy mysteries, and so much more.
Our past book club picks have included Pachinko by Minjin Lee, Patron Saints of Nothing by Randy Ribeye, Grace of Kings by Ken Liu, and The Kiss Quotient by Helen Huang.
Every month, we also go through the latest news in Asian American literature, as well as chat with some awesome Asian authors about their works.
So whether you want to start reading for fun again or diversify your TBR list, we got your Asian literature cravings covered. For more info, check out our website at booksandboba.com, and you can listen to us on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, and wherever you find your podcasts.
Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective. All right, welcome back to the Good Pop Culture Club. On this episode, we are chatting about Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire, the latest film in Legendary Pictures' MonsterVerse, featuring the second team-up movie between Godzilla and King Kong.
Is this not the first? I thought they were fighting in the first one.
I mean, spoiler, they team up at the end because the big bad in the first one was Mechagodzilla. And so in the climax, I'm just spoiling it because I don't care. In the climax,
spoil this. Yeah.
King Kong is being held down by Mechagodzilla and about to be smushed. And then Godzilla uses its atomic breath to charge up King Kong's Godzilla axe so he can defeat Mechagodzilla. It was like,
wow, that the sounds stuff amazing. Of legends.
Yeah.
That sounds amazing. So how are they going to one up that, Marvin, in this movie? Godzilla X Kong, a new empire.
Question. Well, we'll discuss whether they did one of that or not. They definitely did more of that for sure. This film is the 37th film in the Godzilla franchise, the 13th in the King Kong franchise, and the fifth Godzilla movie to be produced by a Hollywood studio. And that does include the Matthew Broderick, I think, 2000 Godzilla movie. The one with the Puff Daddy song in the soundtrack.
Yeah. Oh, that did not age well. But I did watch that one. That's actually the only other Godzilla movie I've watched in theaters, the Matthew Broderick one.
Yeah, I mean, this film stars a pretty star-studded cast of people that are probably maybe too good to be in this film. Dan Stevens, Rebecca Hall, Brian Tyree Henry, Fala Chen, Alex Ferns. Yeah, Jess, you chose this film for me to watch. So I want to know why did you do that?
Okay, number one, I feel like there are a lot of parallels in the friendship relationship of Godzilla and Kong and our friendship, Marvin.
Really?
I would like to discuss Exactly. I think that's something we need to deeply discuss. I think in every friendship their dynamic, there is a Godzilla and there is a Kong. So I think we should talk about that.
Right. So in every relationship, there is one sad monkey and one angry
lizard.
I think
it's very obvious who is who in this situation, Marvin.
Am I the sad
obviously
monkey?
Yes, and I'm obviously Godzilla. But I will say, I think Kong had a very complex arc and inner life in this. And I don't know if that's true in all of these MonsterVerse movies, but, you know, he's a little more humanoid, so it's a little easier to project, like, human-like stories on Kong versus Godzilla is very cool, but, you know, much more mysterious. Likes to curl up in the Colosseum like a little cute pet, just doing property damage everywhere and you know, taking out other titans to harness their power. And if that's not my dream, I don't know what is. Yeah. And then, you know, I will have to say, there has been a lot of discourse in the culture about, you know, what these like big CGI blockbusters are doing to the state of film, the state of movie making, the state of, you know, in a post-Marvel world, like, you know, where everybody wants to be a franchise, and we are kind of, I think, on like a tail end of like quality in a lot of those sense words. But, you know, I do think this is surprisingly, maybe I'm jumping the gun in some of our categories, like in a world where we do get a lot of these kind of like fast food McDonald's releases of film, this is a pretty good version of that, because for me at least it is entertaining. It is bad good, if that makes sense. And most of these movies are just bad, and you're sitting there and you're like, this is boring, or this is like so poorly done. And I think this movie does a really good job of not caring about the people, barely caring about the plot, and just really concentrating on giving people what they came for, which is the spectacle of Godzilla and Kong.
Okay, I will agree with you that the people part is probably the least interesting part of this entire film. Anytime someone actually speaks a line was the worst. But the drama between, you know, of King Kong looking for his family, essentially, of Godzilla just like, you know, being a giant angry lizard, those are great. And I guess we can get into it, which is like, the thing with Godzilla films is the best Godzilla films aren't really about Godzilla. Godzilla happens. It is a force of nature. It's usually an allegory for like natural disaster, or in this case, like climate change, right? But it's really about the human drama of how humanity reacts to something out of their control. And I think that's where these American adaptations kind of fall short, because the first Godzilla, the one by Gareth Edwards, was about like, okay, here is like a force of nature coming in, and like, how do we react to it? What if we're just making things worse? Like, you know, humanity's hubris is usually the biggest villain in these films. But starting with the second one and moving on to the team-up films, humanity's role has been like, how can we control and harness the power of these creatures for our own purposes? And that's how you end up with like machines that talk to the monsters, hovercrafts, like Tony Stark shit, right?
Oh, this whole movie is just a series, at least with the humans and like their tech and what they need to do, and like how the movie gets them from point A to point B. They're all just dux and machinas, right? It's a series of like, how convenient. I'm going to say something, or there is a convenient, again, we're just going to do full spoilers because this is not a movie where spoilers matter.
There's a convenient like, chosen one.
Yeah. There's a convenient mecha arm that is complete for King Kong lying in the ruins of a damaged station.
That just happens to be in that specific station.
Yes, but you know what? Does any of this matter, though, when you realize Dan Stevens' cousin Matthew is gonna, you know, that we're gonna get a mecha arm on King Kong, and you're just like, fuck yes, like, does it matter? To me, it does not.
I came
for the spectacle. I was not expecting, like, depth or You know, anything like that. I came to see Godzilla and Kong fight and then team up, and I think the movie delivered on those two things.
But I think it does matter, right? Like, because this is a film that just does not trust its audience, right? Every single line in this film is explaining something that we're already seeing on
screen. Oh, no. And how convenient that, again, I have not watched any of these other ones. At one point, I turned to Raymond, who I watch this with. I'm like, what is she a doctor of? Like, how can she read just ancient, like, Iwi ruins? Like, that's very convenient. And how convenient that, you know, the Chosen One can recall. Oh, my favorite Deus Ex Machina is the Mothra, just the existence and presence of Mothra. For some reason, Mothra's existence is going to bridge the historic animosity between the Godzilla and the Kongs. And I'm just like, how convenient. But
to be fair, this is something that the fans have been clamoring for, because Mothra did appear in that second film and was totally innocent.
But this was such
a shoehorned way to bring Mothra back.
But when Godzilla, King Kong are both yelling at the sky with Mothra in between them against the backdrop of the pyramids of Giza, did I go, fuck yes? Yes, I did. And did I have a good time? Yes, I did. Again, I did not come for substance. I came for spectacle. And, you know, it is ironic, though, because, again, the people do not matter in this. Really, they do not matter. And we listed this as both what's great about this, what's good and what's not so good, is this cast is just way overqualified. It's like all people we like, right? Like,
these are all good actors who have done stuff that we love.
They are like Yale educated, dramatically trained, like British repertoire actors. Like Rebecca Hall, your father ran the Royal Shakespeare Company for like decades. Like, I think he is no longer with us, but I'm like, man, I wish he could have watched you in this movie. You know, Brian Tyree Henry is a Yale graduate. Fala Chen, who gets zero lines.
She's not all the talk. None of the indigenous people here.
Who are like playing the Iwis are allowed to talk, but because they communicate telepathically. And something about gravity. Don't know. Always fun to see Rachel House. You know, does her character get to do anything? Not really. And Dan Stevens, again, who left Downton Abbey to pursue a film career. I was like, wow, this is what you left. You know what? I hope everyone enjoys their new house that they got from making this movie, because I'm sure they got some new house money. So it is fun to, you know, see people we generally like. Kind of wish they got some more things to do. But I will say, I think the real main character in this movie is Kong. And he gets a pretty interesting story arc. And I think it is actually really akin to like old school, like silent films, because Kong can't talk. You know, they are doing very broad stroke, like very like classic storytelling, right? Like very wolf and what's the Japanese thing? The wolf and cub.
I feel like the cub wasn't actually a child, probably like just a small adult.
I think it was child code. It definitely child code. So you get a little wolf and cub. You get a little Spartacus, you know? And I actually thought that was like very effective. I was like, oh, these are very like classic story beats. And, you know, when one of these mangy ass monkeys, like apes, gets like thrown, like these abused, you know, Kongs is like thrown into the lava, like I cried. I'm like, oh my goodness, this is so tragic. I was like, oh, this is working for me. Again, it's like these very like it's very Greek, right? Like very Greek tragedy. Like you have to use these like very classic elements to get the point across, because again, like this is not only no dialogue, it is also a CGI monkey.
Yeah,
gorilla.
And I definitely did enjoy all the non-human parts, right? Like the big monkey fights, the big bad monkey, which is just like a Joker monkey, right? Like, I'm not usually a fan of Joker-fying. I think Joker-fying villains is a little played out. But this evil grinning monkey who has enslaved the other Titan apes was a pretty compelling foil to, you know, our heroic King Kong.
Yeah, and then, you know, the reveal that the bad guy, who's called the Scar King with the K, you know, has control over like a titan, you know, and that's when I realized I'm like, okay, I see what they're trying to do here. We're gonna get like a 2-on-2 because I'm just like, I'm like, Godzilla can cream this guy, like, no big deal, right? Like, even Kong is like pretty strong and can probably take him. I'm like, what's the catch here? Like, and maybe this is me being slow on the uptake, because which, you know, I am very on the record and very slow on the uptake sometimes. The only one who did not see the twist in Detective Pikachu coming. Still really shook by that, if you can't tell. And you know, and then you're just like, oh my god, this is ridiculous. He's riding the fucking Titan like it's a pet. And I'm just like, oh, this is gonna be great. Like we're it's gonna be a 2-on-2. It's gonna be like a doubles tennis match. And then the gravity stops working, and that's even more amazing.
Yeah, it's definitely a film where, you know, stuff happens. What was the point of turning off gravity? Doesn't matter. It
no
makes
clue.
A cool effect.
Don't understand why or what or how they try to explain why they need to turn off the gravity. The portals make absolutely no sense. Again, it's all just a means to have a big monster titan fight in zero gravity.
One thing that I kept like thinking about is, because like Godzilla is a giant irradiated lizard, I mean, all these tourists running away from him in Rome, they all have cancer now, right? They're all
100%. And I'm just thinking also, like, you know, in the midst of the tragedy in Baltimore with the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge, I'm just looking at this, I'm thinking like, oh my god, these billions if not trillions of dollars in like property damage, I'm just like, ooh, the infrastructure's crumbled. Like, ooh, girl. Like, you know, he is nice enough to generally leave the Colosseum intact. He does take down a wall.
Well, he likes it as his bed.
Yeah, that's very cute. It's very dog-like, which I appreciate. You know, I'm a sucker for animals, pets. You know, but then when we do take it to, like, the human world, like when they're fighting outside Rio, and then you see all these people, you know, the fatalities must be in the what? Like, we're talking, like 4-digit range, 5-digit range,
probably more. Like, yeah, like,
you think so?
All those buildings being like, I don't think they had time to evacuate.
No, yeah,
Rio de Janeiro, or
that's fair,
or Spain. You know,
and is there a website or is there some blog or does anyone do this work? Like, they calculate the mass casualties just based off like sample size of these like movies.
I mean, Godzilla X Kong, essentially, it is a superhero movie now, right? Just like Fast and Furious, just like all the Marvel and DC films. In the third act, you need to have a giant city leveling battle where buildings go boom. And, you know, for a kaiju film, that does make sense. Like, that's kind of what we are here for. But, you know, this film really isn't interested in telling the story of those people on the ground, right? Like, the people we're following are members of like a multinational conglomerate whose job is to monitor titans using all of their like bullshit technology that can do whatever they want, right? Like, they're just there to move the plot along.
I mean, how does one even become a titan veterinarian? Like what does Tiamat need from you? Like, is your only client Kong? Like, how does one make a living off of that is my question. Yes, sorry, if we forgot to mention, Dan Stevens' character is a veterinarian for large creatures.
I was actually thinking that too. Like, how, like, what are, who are your other clients? Who pays you to take care of these giant monsters?
I mean, I assume Monarch, which is, I guess, a government entity or government-affiliated entity.
Right, but the only kaiju that they're actually, like, have, like, a friendly relationship with is Kong. All the other titans want to eat them.
Yes, exactly. But I guess, you know, you just need one rich patron, and he had that tooth ready to go. So again, this movie makes no sense. It doesn't need to, because at the end of the day, we're here to watch these two monster,
but it does make me curious to check out that Monarch TV show.
Who's in that one? What Yale educated Tony Award winning, like, classically trained actors do they have in that one?
Well, I know it stars NSOY, who we last watched on Shogun.
Yes.
And I guess Kurt Russell.
Oh, how fun. Kurt Russell and Wyatt Russell. He's playing a younger version of his dad. How fun.
I mean, these projects somehow bring out the big guns, right? Like, Brian Tyree Henry was in the last Godzilla versus Kong, along Millie Bobby Brown, who was herself in the last Godzilla film. Godzilla versus Kong also starred Alexander Skarsgård and Asa Gonzalez, who we also last saw as the initial Mr. and Mrs. Smith in the TV series, right?
I do have to ask you about Brian Tyree Henry's character, Marvin. He is a conspiracy theorist podcaster. How do you feel about the representation of podcasters in this movie?
I feel like this is probably how Han feels whenever journalists are represented in rom-coms, which is podcasters are not radio hosts. It doesn't matter if we get interrupted midstream because we can just push pause.
That's your biggest problem?
That's a problem. I just feel like, okay, podcasting, I can be a podcaster. It's easy. Anyone can be a podcaster, right? But the fact
that's
his whole personality and I don't know. His character is just really like, the thing is, having seen him do better,
like he can cook. Let Brian Tyree Henry cook.
Yeah.
But again, all of these folks can cook, but they are stuck in a hollow earth Iwi village with a group of folks who cannot speak verbally, reading ancient ruins.
And so they have to explain everything for them. And that's like, yes, it's such a knowing how like both Godzilla and King Kong, like their original stories are about the hubris of man, right? And there are films in this same series that explore those really well. Like Godzilla and Kong Skull Island are great films that explore those themes.
Here's my thing. Do you think you would actually like this movie if it was like 2 degrees worse? Like if it just leaned like even campier, a la like Madame Web?
I don't think so. It's not bad in the ways that I enjoy, right? It's not, I can put up with cheesiness and camp, but maybe it's because I read a lot more now. I just don't enjoy lazy writing. And a lot of the stuff that happens in this film, specifically the non-monster parts, are full of that, right? Like the sheer amount of deus ex machina in this film should be illegal.
I feel like I'm also someone who like has no pre-existing relationship with like Godzilla or King Kong. Like I'm not very precious with either of those. So for me, like it, like, and again, I know, especially in this, you know, last year where like we got a very critically and like publicly loved Godzilla film that's like kind of more true to its roots. Like I get that, but I'm not just like, but like this could be the same fun as Fast and the Furious, you know, like there is no logic. There is no physics. There's no reason in these movies. It is just vibes and screaming into the air and the girlfriend Mothra coming out to stop the fighting.
Yeah, and those parts are all great. Like the monster fighting King Kong's, you know, journey to find his people and finding, you know, the remnants of its kind. Godzilla, you know, doing his thing, fighting other monsters for their powers. I think it just comes down to like the humans, the story with the humans where they have to like dump lore on you, explain things. Like even the scene where Dan Stevens appears and he has like a plotting conversation with Rebecca Hall's character talking about like, oh, we used to have history.
Right? Oh yeah, that was like so fun. He's like, wow, they're really trying this right now. yeah. Do you think this movie, the studio should have been braver and just gotten rid of the humans altogether and just opened and closed with Kong, followed that story through, basically making it a silent movie, not silent, but you know, like a movie with no dialogue and just telling the story through
that
lens.
Honestly, I think I would have enjoyed that way more.
I think that would have been actually really cool, like even as an experiment, right? Just because there is always something very sad boy about Kong.
Yeah, like he starts off so sad. He was like, he's so sad. He just wants hunting dogs and making crafts and. You know, that scene where he like hears a call and it turns out to be just like a frog mimicking like a Kong call. Like, that was so sad, right?
Like, it was sad.
I think I agree with you. The storytelling during the Kong, like the King Kong exploring Hollow World scenes, those really worked. You know, like it helps that Kong is a gorilla who can make emotional faces, right?
Because they gave him like eyebrow ridges. Yeah. That's really important. I learned that from Lion King. If they got no eyebrows, you can't really emote.
Yeah, and it was really cool seeing him just like whenever he like brings the axe over his shoulder, and poses. I mean, I was
okay.
Like,
the axe is fucking cool. Every time he like screams into the sky, I was like, "Fuck yeah, dude! I get it. Wednesdays, am I right?" And you know when he's like, when he's on his little like road, when you know the middle part of the movie where it becomes like a road trip movie where him and the little monkey who I had to Google, his name is Suko, are like, you know, being brought back. You know, he's telling Suko like, bring me back to like where you're from. And you know, Suko's hungry and is obviously like very scared and like just has been through a lot. And like, you know, Kong shares like some meat with him, which I'm also like, aren't gorillas herbivores? Aren't like most things that big herbivores? Because something about biology, but I digress. In this movie, not the point.
Biology doesn't matter in this film. It matters in Shin Godzilla, but not in Godzilla X Kong.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, I do wish there was like a little more. Again, I don't think that's Godzilla's game, but it would be cool to kind of get the balance, you know, that balance in the Godzilla side too. But I kind of get, you know, he's a radioactive lizard that like, my question is, why does he feel so, like, why does he protect humanity? Was that addressed in the previous movies?
He doesn't protect humanity per se. He protects the Earth. He is like, I think in the second film, they describe him as like, he is the antibody to like these other creatures who are like essentially climate change.
Got it. So he's got it. Okay. So, you know, he's more of a tool, I guess, than like a... Like,
I mean,
a,
he's
like
essentially just like a natural disaster. I mean, he's still a natural disaster. It's just they imbue him with a lot more personality.
Yeah. But I mean, I did really enjoy it when they're fighting initially because Godzilla takes one good look at King Kong and is like, it's on fucking sight. Like, I don't want to talk, right? Like, King Kong's like, I need, like, hear me out. I need to talk to you about something. And Godzilla's like, fuck that. It's on sight. I told you to go downward and stay down, bitch. And that's all great. And, you know, when... This wasn't the trailer, which, you know, pet peeve of like showing the best parts in the trailer. But, you know, when Godzilla is like swimming along, moving along, and then King Kong grabs on and like rides him for a hot second, but not in like the disrespectful way the Scar King rides his Titan, but more like a partnership of like, I'm gonna catch a ride. I was like, fuck yeah, this is what the movies are about. It's a team up.
Yeah. I mean, the scene where Kong and Godzilla and Mothra just appear and just like slow-mo run into the battlefield, way better. I wish that was the only slow-mo walk we had in the film and not the dumb slow-mo walk to the cover craft we had early in the film.
Oh, yeah.
With the human characters.
I will. Okay, you know what? I'm going to be honest. I don't think I'm either of them. I think I'm Mothra. I think I just show up. I look cute. I fly around. I scream a little bit. And then I go back home. Maybe I'm Mothra.
The film was fun. Like, was it good? No. Was it fun?
No.
Yeah.
Yes.
For the most part.
Yes. Which to me is all I can ask for in a movie like this. So I'm going to ask and answer the question, is this good pop? Yes, I think it is. I don't know where this franchise is going. Don't really care. You know, I think more monsters, less humans wouldn't be a terrible note to take or consider legendary, but... I had a great time, and thank you, Marvin, for sharing this experience with me.
I don't know if I can give this the whole good pop endorsement. Like, again, like, it was fun. The kaiju battles was fun. Was it a good film? No, it wasn't. And I don't know where this franchise goes. I feel like it should go the Planet of the Apes route, where the next film should just be in a post-human world and just let the kaijus fight each other. I think that would be a way more interesting story if this is what, you know, the Hollywood legendary monsterverse wants to go down.
But man, yeah. That sounds super expensive. Every time I'm looking at this frame, I'm like, man, that's the triple, like, I know this costs $100 million. Oh, that's a few million dollars.
Yeah. And, you know, if they do want to go down this road where they're, like, building up, like, Monarch as, like, the humans developing technologies to coexist with kaiju, you know, go all the way. Next film, just
Mecha.
Bring in Pacific Rim, right?
Yes. Yes.
I would watch that. Add in a Mecha. I will sit through your bullshit exposition and bad writing for Mecha versus King Kong versus Godzilla action.
That is 100% how actual humans in our world would react to, right? They'd be like, oh, this is too unchecked. We got to create some kind of like nuclear super weapon again to try to do it. Let's get a pilot in there. 100% that is what should happen and what would happen in real life.
Yeah. All right. Well, on that note, that'll do it for a discussion of Godzilla X Kong, the new empire in theaters now. Jess, thank you. Thank you for making me watch this with you. If people want to find out more of your thoughts, where can they go?
My trash takes are on Twitter at JustYouTweets.
And you can find me on social media at Marvin Yuet. You can find our show at goodpop.club. We are a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective. Check out our fellow Asian American hosted podcast by going to the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks so much for listening to the Good Pop Culture Club. We'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Hello, I'm Phil Yu, and I'm the host of All the Asians on Star Trek, the podcast in which I interview all the Asians on Star Trek. I'm talking to actors, writers, directors, stunt people, background extras. You know, all the Asians on Star Trek. Find out more at alltheasiansonstartrek.com. Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective. Live long and prosper.